So, good afternoon. I'll call the March 28th meeting of the Ag Finance and Policy Committee to order. This remote meeting will be held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. Roll call, Mr. Smith, please.
Chair Sundin. Sure. Vice Chair Vang.
Present.
Representative Anderson. Representative Burkle.
Burkle present.
Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Hansen R.
Hansen R. present.
Representative Hansen J.
Hansen J. present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert present.
Representative Lewick.
Present.
Representative Miller.
Miller present.
Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Representative Thompson.
Thompson present.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have minutes to the meeting of March 23rd. Chair Vang, I'm assuming you've inspected the minutes. Do you have a motion?
I move to adopt the minutes of the previous meeting, Chair.
Any questions on that motion? Hearing none, seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay, those opposed, nay. Okay, the motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have three bills up today. Also, as many of you probably saw over the weekend, we had our first confirmed case of the highly pathogenic avian influenza over the weekend. Commissioner Peterson and Dr. Thompson, hopefully, will join us later in the meeting to provide an update. First up, we have Representative Stevenson. Welcome to the committee. You have the first bill up today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the chair moves House File 3913 for possible inclusion in the supplemental finance bill. Chair Stevenson, the bill is before us. Please introduce your bill and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill relates to the bioincentive program. It does three things. It provides funding to repay facilities that were underpaid in previous years for a total of $7 million. It also provides full funding forward for companies that are already in the program. That's $15 million. And last, it sunsets the program, thus disallowing any new applicants beyond the end of 2022. This program's been around for 7 years. It's designed to support development of new technology in areas of advanced biofuel and bio-based chemical product. Importantly, corn ethanol and soybean biodiesel are not eligible in this program. Biofuels must be advanced biofuels that achieve a 50% greenhouse gas reduction relative to gasoline. It has had a pretty significant economic impact. It's led to $690 million in spending, leading to $1.2 billion in economic activity. For every tax dollar spent by the state, it's generated $407 in the economy and $8, nearly $9 in new tax collections. But we have never kept our up our end of the deal in terms of what was initially contemplated in the program in terms of funding. And so this bill basically fulfills the original funding agreement that was established in 2015 and helps ensure that those people who made investments based on that promise are kept whole, and then brings the program to a graceful conclusion at that point. Mr. Chair, I believe there are several testifiers, or at least one, willing to talk about the bill as well.
Okay, thank you, Chair Stevenson. First up, we have Brendan Jordan from the Great Plains Institute. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative Stevenson. My name is Brendan Jordan. Vice President of Transportation and Fuels at the Great Plains Institute. I am here today representing the Bioeconomy Coalition. The coalition is a multi-stakeholder coalition that includes agriculture, forestry, local governments, nonprofit environmental organizations, industry groups, and startup companies. The coalition aims to support innovation in bio-based industries, add value to Minnesota natural resources, and create a sustainable bioeconomy. House File 3913 is a really important bill for helping to achieve our goals for the state. The program has been around since 2015. We like to argue it's sort of a boondoggle-proof program. The state only pays once investment has already taken place, once facilities have already been built, private investment has already taken place, the jobs are already there. So there's really very little risk for the state with this program, but it does depend on the state keeping up its sort of its end of the bargain. It has led to a lot of exciting innovation in the state, multiple facilities throughout the state, including things like cellulosic ethanol, which is an advanced biofuel technology that utilizes waste to produce biofuels without requiring any new harvest of any crops. It also has really supported new markets for waste wood, which would otherwise be underutilized, and has supported innovation in the forest products industry. Mr. Chair and Representative, we urge support for this really important bill. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Next up, we have Rick Corden, Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Forest Industries. Please introduce yourself to the committee and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Sundin and committee members. As stated, my name is Rick Horton. I'm the Executive Vice President of Minnesota Forest Industries. We're a trade organization representing the primary wood-consuming mills in the state of Minnesota. Minnesota's forests produce a huge overabundance of waste material that could be used to meet human demands for energy, transportation, fuels, and biochemicals. Residues from mills, logging byproducts, wood, and wood damaged by insects, wildfire, and windstorms generate millions of tons of biomass energy annually. One study suggested there was over 600,000 tons annually available within 75 miles of Grand Rapids alone. The DNR has over 400,000 tons of biomass unsold annually from state lands. Utilizing these materials and transforming them into higher valued products would be good for the forest products industry. It would create more jobs in rural Minnesota and would provide an excellent tool for managing our forests to be healthier and more resilient to climate change. The Minnesota Forest Resources Council, of which I am a member, recently released Resolution 2022-1 entitled Supporting Minnesota's Climate Change Goals Through the Development of Sustainable Forest Products Markets. That is in your committee packets. In it, the MFRC recommends support for new and expanded Minnesota markets for forest and mill residuals and other types of sustainably harvested woody biomass. Furthermore, the Forest Resources Council, through its site-level forest management guidelines, has established guidelines for biomass harvesting that ensure that enough is left behind on the landscape to enrich soils, prevent erosion, and provide habitat for wildlife. The AGRI Bioincentive Program provides the financial incentive for companies to invest in Minnesota and bring technologies into the state to sustain and expand markets for biomass. A couple of our member companies are enrollees, and as was stated earlier, the payments have not kept a pace with the demand in this program. So MFI encourages you to pass House File 3913 for the betterment of our forest health, our climate, and our rural economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Horton. We also have a couple of people. Megan Lennon from the department. She's a bioeconomy program manager, and I'm Andrea Vobel, deputy commissioner at the department. I would guess I would pose the first question to either the author or Mr. Horton. Can you tell us specifically about the sweetener that's derived? I have a particular interest because of the interest of Sappy Paper Mill in Cloquet. They've got a proposal, and I know this product that they will be producing, hopefully, is produced in Canada and elsewhere. And can you tell us about that? Some more detail?
Mr. Chair, I would refer that to Mr. Horton. I thought you were going to say you're interested because of your sweet tooth, but I certainly don't think that I'm the right. I would ask Mr. Horton if he could answer that one.
Mr. Chair, sure. So Sappy enrolls in this program. They make a product called dissolving cellulose, which is shipped in raw form elsewhere, where it is spun into a cotton-like fiber and used to make linens and shirts and clothing. It's called Tercel. You can actually purchase it in Minnesota. You can look for that brand name. There's a couple of others out there that do that. So it's a replacement for cotton, which is, you know, can be hard on the environment in some places. So the sweetener, if I'm not mistaken, so that's another enrollee called Lonza. They're in Cohasset. And the product they make is called arabinogalactin. And every time I say it, I pat myself on the back because I remember what it is. It's a smoothener and an additive in makeup and in foods and things like that. So they make it out of tamarack. So they get the arabinogalactin out of tamarack wood, and it's a biochemical that's used in a number of different products.
Okay, and that sweetener, I understand, is actually, when used in food product, it's non-diabetic reactive.
Right.
Is that true?
That's what I understand. I've been in meetings where the mill manager from Lonza would stir it into his coffee just to prove how safe it was and drink it. So.
Great. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Comments? Chair Hansen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, after being around for several years, whenever there is something that is ethanol or biofuels, there's always an implication that there were contracts, that there were requirements, and meeting the intent that there's an entitlement that the money should be provided, the public money should be provided to the private business. And, you know, I've looked through the bill, remember these conversations when we were dealing with regular ethanol. And, you know, I don't see a contract. I don't see a requirement that the state must provide money for biofuels, whether they're advanced or not. So I don't see that requirement. I understand when we put things in the base that that's it, but a legislature can't bind a future legislature that they must provide $15 million in the future, unless it's in the base, unless we vote on that. So I think it's important whenever we have these discussions on biofuels that we understand the difference between a contract and a law and a requirement and an entitlement. My question is, how do you get cellulosic material? Because in the early 2000s, the answer was going to be cellulosic ethanol. It was going to be an advanced biofuel. And my understanding of the chemistry, you have to break down the cellulose to lignin and then get it to a starch and then to sugar versus corn ethanol, where you have a starch to go to sugar to ethanol, or a sugar beet where you're going essentially to sugar to ethanol. So what is the process from getting from cellulose to lignin to starch to sugar, and what are the byproducts and how are they handled there?
Mr. Harden, would you like to tackle that one?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen. So there's a number of different ways to do that. That splitting of the lignin and the cellulose and hemicellulose happens in chemical pulping process in our existing paper mills and has for a number of years. In making the fuels, there's a similar process that I'm familiar with, a company that has a proprietary process to use catalytic enzymes to perform that split. And then the cellulose and hemicellulose, as you said, are sugars. They can be used to make ethanol, no different than corn ethanol. What's exciting is the technology to take the lignin, which is essentially structurally in a tree. It's the part that gives it strength so that it can become tall and wind strong and everything. It's a tarry-like substance that has an awful lot of different chemicals in it. And from it, there's technology now to make jet fuel, renewable diesel that's chemically identical to petroleum-based diesel, and products like that, and plastics. They're experimenting with, in fact, I think in the LCCMR package this year, there's a project to make injection molding plastic out of lignin. So there's a lot that they can do with that. Carbon fiber, I've heard that they can make out of that. So the technology is there. It's just a matter of attracting it so that it exists here in our state and those investments are made here.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of comments and a question.
interested in why the end date of the program is moved up 3 years. And Mr. Horton just mentioned renewable jet fuel. And my concern is, you know, that's really just getting off the ground now. It's not producing enough to satisfy this huge demand for renewable jet fuel that's being asked for. And by moving up the expiration date by 3 years, I think we may be cutting off that industry from really getting ramped up and qualifying for this program in time to be eligible for some of the payments. So Representative Stevenson, if you could comment on reasoning for why the program is going to be ending 3 years
early. Chair Stevenson, please.
3 years
early.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. I think we have a program that we have not been funding at levels that were anticipated when it first came in. I think it's just now that we're approaching already the end of the program in 2025, it makes sense to sort of move that up while simultaneously making a whole the people who have participated in today. But I think Mr. Jordan might also be able to comment on this question.
Mr. Jordan, can you help us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, I think Chair Stevenson really captured it. It's just a case of, you know, the program's not fully funded for the companies that are already in the program. And so, you know, adding more companies would just, you know, stretch inadequate dollars even further. Of course, you know, as a coalition, we would certainly welcome opportunities to attract more companies, and we're excited about sustainable aviation fuel as well. It really just the core issue is just the underfunding of the program.
Okay. Representative Anderson?
Just a final comment then. Well, some of the programs we institute, if the demand for payments exceeds the available grant amount, we prorate those amounts. And in this program here, we're hearing that the program really attracted a lot of interest and activity, and the amounts requested are more than the grant amounts. But we're going to add money to make those amounts whole, make them full. And maybe we could have looked at the prorating and then added more companies to add into the program. So that's just my concern with the bill, and I will end my conversation there. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Okay, seeing none, hearing none. Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Appreciate your time today. House File 3913 is laid over. Next up, we have... Representative Anderson, do you have something further? Okay. Next up, we have... Representative Albright, welcome to the committee. We have a horse racing conversation here. Representative Anderson, your second author on the bill. Would you like to move House File 3800 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill?
I would do that, Mr. Chair. I'd move that House file for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Albright, tell us about your bill, and we'd like to hear from your testifiers as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 3800 reflects the importance of the horse racing industry to the state. And before I defer to my testifier, I just want to point up a couple of facts that I think contextually will remind us of just how important that is. The horse racing industry in Minnesota creates $400 million of economic impact to the state. It also creates 5,500 jobs. It is, has been, and will continue to be a very valued entertainment venue in the River South Corridor, which I represent a portion of. The bill before you, House File 3800, is a one-time economic stimulus pilot program that'll pay for benefits to Minnesota agribusiness well into the future. And my testifier will expand on that. These additional grants create to provide for mental health and educational programs of the horse racing industry and the people that it serves, as well as the local communities and the farmers that collaterally also benefit from the horse racing industry. I have with me this morning Joe Skirtle, the president of the Minnesota Thoroughbred Racing Alliance, and he is here to give us more details on the program and its benefits. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would defer the remainder of the time for this presentation to Mr. Skirto. Thank you.
Mr. Skirto, please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Joe Skirto, president of the Minnesota Thoroughbred Racing Alliance, former deputy director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, and executive director of the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project. Thank you for having me today. Thank you to Representative Albright and Anderson for sponsoring our bill, and to Commissioner Peterson for helping us work through some of the mechanics of what you have in front of you. I'd like to share a short PowerPoint presentation with you if the technology works for me, if I may.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The bill you have in front of you provides the opportunity to attract and keep more thoroughbred racehorses in Minnesota, accelerate economic and agricultural benefits to the state, and provide support services to the community and those that care for these equine athletes. Agriculture in Minnesota has traditionally been focused on cows, pigs, and chickens. One of our goals is to make thoroughbreds as important in our state's economy as any other livestock or agricultural product. In the horse racing world, thoroughbreds can be viewed as mobile sports franchises. Several ingredients go into an owner's decision where to race their horses: money available, purses, conditions for their workers, stable area services, access to professional veterinary services, and quality agricultural products are all part of the mix. Traditionally, a state's breeding program provided a home team for racetracks. These were the horses that were given incentives to race in the state in which they were born. Unfortunately, due to uncertainty of future economic conditions, the transition to mobile wagering platforms, the loss of breeding farms, in the recent COVID-19 pandemic, the amount of money available for breeders' incentives is in decline. The result has been the number of thoroughbred foals born in Minnesota has dropped by almost two-thirds. Minnesota horse racing produces over $400 million in annual economic activity. A thoroughbred racehorse that spends a summer racing at Canterbury Park will cost its owner an average of $15,000, plus the transportation costs of getting to Minnesota and the capital investment of purchasing or raising the horse. Canterbury Park, along with its racing participants, also pay to provide a stable area that includes housing, education, and health services to people that come here each year to take care of their horses. The number of jobs and size of the labor force connected to a thoroughbred racehorse is often underestimated or simply not on the radar of most legislators or chambers of commerce. The diversity of skill levels and commitments to the jobs performed by all cogs in the wheel is inspiring. The jobs centered around the horse is only part of the picture. There are also all the labor committed to making sure the public has an entertaining day at Canterbury Park. This combination makes horse racing a powerful economic engine for both agriculture and business in Minnesota. In addition to the jobs produced, the impact on agriculture and the products consumed, all of which are produced or distributed right here in Minnesota, is substantial. The average thoroughbred will consume 25 pounds of food per day. On any given day, you can see trailer loads of hay, feed, bedding, and other products being delivered to Canterbury Park in their stable area. You will also see trailers hauling horses, veterinary trucks going barn to barn, and food trucks stationed to serve our people. The pilot program is designed to increase demand for local agricultural products, grow the need for supportive services like veterinary, transportation, and retail supplies, create additional jobs and equine-related educational internships, support mental health, both for the industry and general community, and provide ESL and summer school for children and adults in our primarily immigrant stable area community. This one-time appropriation will create a program that will become self-sustaining by way of its own success. By the state providing a launching pad, more thoroughbreds will come to Minnesota. More will race, more races will be run, and in turn, more money will be available to fund future incentives. This is a true agricultural and economic stimulus bill. How does the program actually work? First, it requires any thoroughbred racehorse to spend a minimum of 120 days in Minnesota. Once that's been achieved, they will become Minnesota certified by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Once certified, each racehorse would receive a $750 stipend for each race it competes in until the race career is over. It will also make the horse eligible to participate in our aftercare programs designed to keep these horses in the state for the rest of their lives. Other states like Virginia and Delaware have seen success with similar programs. We base the length of stay for eligibility and incentives in the middle of what these other states provide in order to provide a tested foundation for this pilot program. The payoff is getting more horses to come to Minnesota. Last year, there were 1,100 thoroughbreds residing in the stable area of Canterbury Park. Unfortunately, the current trend shows that number dropping to 900 within the next 2 years. With this program, we can reverse the trend and look to bringing 1,500 horses into the state, and along with it, a $60 million positive economic impact. Not only do we want these horses to come race in Minnesota, but we also want them to stay as they move on to their next career. The pilot program in front of you provides $500,000 in annual grants from the Department of Agriculture available to nationally accredited organizations, Racing Commission approved groups, and Minnesota colleges and universities that have equine programs doing this work. A typical thoroughbred racehorse will retire from racing by age 7. The average lifespan of a thoroughbred is 25 years. That means a thoroughbred will have 18 years in a different capacity. An owner of a retired thoroughbred will have annual expenditures averaging $7,500 and thus expend $135,000 over its lifetime. When we keep our thoroughbreds here in Minnesota, it will support agribusiness, secure open space, and simply make Minnesota better. As you can see by the map, the footprint of where these horses are currently preparing for their next career is expanding and will eventually touch all corners of the state. We also have two programs available that have a real human element. These include an educational program called Furlong Learning that provides summer school as well as ESL training for people that work and live on the backside at Canterbury Park. Additionally, this funding would be directed towards mental health programs like Abijah's on the Backside that provides mental health and support for people suffering from PTSD, depression, and addiction for both stable area workers as well as those in the community. We all thank you for your support and consideration of this bill, and I stand ready to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Skirto.
Thank you.
Are there any questions, comments from the committee, please? Okay. I might ask, you know, is there another bill? Representative Wasilik is moving through the process, and that allows for current horse breeder cup funds to be used for this purpose. There's no cost to the state taxpayers. Representative Albright or Mr. Skirto, why is this approach better than that? Mr. Skirto?
Thank you, Chairman. This approach, what it does is it provides grants for different programs. The bill that the Minnesota Racing Commission has put forward just changes language so that they may provide funds for aftercare. So there's also that funding from the Minnesota Racing Commission could also be used for promotion. It could be used for administrative expenses. And what they're looking to do is add and aftercare. These grants would be available money for that program, for these programs.
Okay. Just wondering about the feed for the horses. You know, is there an economic benefit, you know, for the local farmers rather than importing specialized feed in from outside the state?
Mr. Chairman and representatives, absolutely. Sure.
Okay.
What we are looking to do is our Minnesota HBPA, which represents the horsemen and the trainers and the grooms and so forth, are working on co-op programs with local farmers and local feed producers in order to achieve exactly that.
Okay. Representative Anderson, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Albright, thanks for bringing us this bill. It's very interesting to learn the cost of maintaining a thoroughbred. I guess they call them hay burners for that reason. But the amount of hay, good quality hay and grass hay, and barley, oats, and whatever else the horses eat. And it has to be a good diet to have them up to the regimens of race day and such. So really appreciate that. I did have a question for Mr. Skirto when you mentioned that these thoroughbreds have a typical lifespan of about 25 years. They race for 7 years. So in those other 18 years, could they be kind of adopted by private families? And can they be ridden for pleasure in those years? Or what can those horses do then in those later years of their life? Mr. Skirto?
Mr. Skirto, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, thank you for the question. Indeed, they are doing... Retired thoroughbreds now are doing more than they've ever done before. They can continue on in athletic careers, equine events, hunting, jumping, dressage, Western, we're seeing more in barrel racing, or simply pleasure riding. One of the things that we've developed in the last 2 years has actually been people have adopted these horses simply to go out and take care of them on other farms, not necessarily their farm. People that live in urban areas are coming out to organizations like This Old Horse and Racehorse Reimagined and spending time with their horse, learning how to groom them. And they find the mental health benefits of that to be very rewarding.
Thank you very much.
Representative Anderson, any follow-up on that?
No final comments, Mr. Chair, no.
Okay, thank you. You know, it's nice to know there's a retirement program for I guess used up racehorses, retiring racehorses. I wish there was such a program for retiring legislators. Any further comments, Representative Albright?
Mr. Chair, maybe that's a bill that you could work on in terms of putting legislators out to pasture. I think that's called an election. I would remind the committee that, you know, coming from an economics background, when I take a look at this bill and I appreciate $400 million of economic impact to the state as well as 5,500 jobs, when you take a look at the fiscal impact in terms of what the ask is on House File 3800, which literally is 0.1% of the economic impact that horse racing has to the state. What we're doing is we're promoting literally an expansion on that to conservatively another $60 million, if not more, for, as it has been said, professional athletes that not only provide entertainment, but also economic incentives for those services and providers that augment the establishment of those horses in the state. And as I might add, as Representative Anderson said, there is an aftermarket, if you will, for these athletes as they move into other areas and other chapters of their life after racing, and which is beneficial to the state and beneficial to a number of organizations. So With that, Mr. Chair, I would encourage members to think fondly and appreciatively of this bill as you lay it over for possible inclusion in your omnibus bill. Thank you, members and Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. This has been enlightening. With that, House File 3800 is laid over. Chair Hansen, you have the next bill. We've actually touched on this last year, and I understand you want to continue the discussion. So please move your bill and begin. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 766 be referred to the Environment Committee. And then I do have a DE amendment.
Do you want to move your amendment first?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the DE amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like.
Okay. And the description of the DE or
yes,
not?
Mr. Chair. So the DE, this is the treated seed effort that was done last year. In the interim, there have been continuing discussions between myself and the Department of Ag and the Pollution Control Agency. And there are some changes to what we had passed off the House floor in both the House Ag Omnibus and the Senate. So first off, in Section 1, as we were researching this, we discovered that throughout the seed law, there were some references to coated agricultural seed, but there were not any definitions of coated agricultural seed. So this is actually creating a definition for coated agricultural seed that can be used. And as you know, definitions are important. Next up is the requirement, again, that the treated seed not be used for food, feed, oil, or ethanol feedstock. Any of that treated seed with neonicotinoid pesticides. This goes back to the issue that was in Nebraska, that we do have a testifier who can reference that. One of the issues was defining when seed, which is unused, becomes waste. And so this provides the commissioner in consultation with the PCA provide information on treated seed with neonicotinoids on how it can be disposed and how it cannot be disposed, and rulemaking would be required. The reason that this is going to the Ag or to the Environment Committee is that the Pollution Control Agency responsibility for disposal rests in the Environment Committee. In addition, to help inform folks using seed, there's also an appropriation for consumer guidance to help and publicize. So this is treated seed, whether it's for the garden or for the farm. So that is the DE, and it provides the money for rulemaking to the PCA. So I'd ask for your support for the DE.
Thank you. Any questions to the author on the DE2 amendment? Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment, I guess, Representative Hansen just told us there were some fairly substantial changes made from the original bill, which was introduced a year ago. And when there's a DE amendment that's turned in, it kind of precludes the minority party from offering any amendments because we don't know what's in the DE amendment until it's been sent to the committee administrator as well. So just a comment that it's difficult for us to offer any amendments if we were going to on this DE amendment, being it was offered itself as an amendment, and we don't have the 24-hour rule to establish any amendments. So just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Understand. We do have adequate time to discuss this if there's any other questions on that amendment. Any other comment, questions? Okay, seeing no further questions, all those in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Okay, that motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We have some testifiers here. Judy Wu Smart available for to offer testimony. Did I get that name right? There you go. Ms. Smart.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much. Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Wu Smart, spelled J-U-D-Y-W-U-S-M-A-R-T. I'm an assistant professor and extension specialist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln in the Department of Entomology. And I want to first thank Representative Rick Hansen for inviting me to testify here. I testified a year ago regarding the consistent bee losses we were experiencing due to the systemic pesticide pollution caused by a facility that was processing treated seed as a way of disposing of that seed and to produce ethanol. This created an immense amount of solid and liquid byproducts that was contaminated with systemic pesticide residues. And 1 year later, you know, I'm here to just kind of testify that there remains no regulatory division at EPA to respond to pollinator losses and concerns related to systemic pesticide pollution. Now, the pollinator protection policies are governed by the Department of Ag and under FIFRA, but the federal loophole that allows treated articles such as pesticide-treated seeds to become exempt from pesticide regulation is still in place. And that challenges individual states in responding to their concerns over the safety and the use and disposal of these treated seeds. I've helped lawmakers better understand these complex issues and concerns, not just in Nebraska and Minnesota, but also in Vermont and New York. And so I understand that having a piecemeal approach and different state regulations can be complicating for businesses, but there are some common sense improvements that could be easily adopted and is frankly made necessary by the federal exemptions. For example, clear language regarding at what point and when in the life of a treated seed does it become classified as hazardous waste? This has been at the root of the problem in Nebraska, and the company argued for years that they don't produce a waste, but economically viable byproducts that was sold and distributed to farmers without knowledge of the contaminants for years. Does the treated seed become hazardous waste when the pesticide is no longer effective or when the seed is no longer viable? Or should it be when the product is no longer being used for its intended purpose? A simple explanation expiration date based on seed viability and product effectiveness clearly printed on the seed bags could help clarify that. Also, there already exists robust regulations on solid waste, air, soil, and water pollution, but the residues of systemic pesticides can move across matrices from the waste into water, into soil, and into vegetation. Are the regulatory agencies prepared and supported to monitor non-target movement of these residues? Not unless they're able to determine the amounts and types of chemicals initially introduced into a system and intentionally introduced. Then people can determine the unintended movements and exposures. These systemic neonicotinoid products are widely available in ag and urban uses. But while they've been shown to be less toxic to mammals, they've also been shown to cause a suite of ecological harm. And chemical overloading from multiple sources and chemical types, as it is in the case of Nebraska, can cause too much complexity and uncertainty to rule out potential adverse harm to the environment and humans. And this is kind of the response that EPA has given to our situation. And while what's happening in Nebraska is certainly an extreme example with unprecedented contamination loads, it does echo real concerns people have about the many unknowns surrounding these compounds. I'd like to end by noting that the benefits of having individual state responses to systemic pesticide concerns is that there's an opportunity here to evaluate these chemicals and where they are a benefit and where, in which scenarios, are they not. Eliminating or reducing the uses where there are little to no value allows us to better conserve these products for the systems that truly do rely on them. The lack of knowledge regarding the use, movement, spread, persistence, and toxicity highlights the need to reevaluate benefits and risks of systemic pesticides like neonicotinoids. And I think HF 766 begins to address these knowledge gaps. Thank you, committee, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Smart. Next up, we have Sarah Hoyle. Please identify yourself and offer your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Sarah Hoyle with the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, here to support House File 766, and Hoyle is H-O-Y-L-E. As a group working directly with farmers across Minnesota and the rest of the country, we're well-versed in the importance of balancing pest management and wildlife conservation. North America's wild pollinators are facing precipitous declines, with roughly 17% of butterflies and 28% of bumblebee species at risk of extinction. These pollinator declines are linked to habitat loss, pesticide use, and diseases, and more. House File 766 takes a small step to address the risk that certain pesticides can pose to pollinators and communities. Neonicotinoid insecticides, or neonics, are a priority concern for pollinators because they're long-lived, highly toxic, and systemic. They're also very prevalent in our landscape since they're applied to the vast majority of corn and soybean seed planted across the country. Despite treated seeds' widespread use, it is actually exempted from federal pesticide regulations through a loophole. There are numerous exposure pathways for pollinators from treated seed, now including their quote-unquote disposal in ethanol plants. So in response to the severe pesticide contamination that we saw at an ethanol plant in Mead, Nebraska that processed treated seed, House File 766 prohibits the use of neonic treated seed in ethanol production. Neonics can harm invertebrates at levels as low as one part per billion or even below, but they've actually been found in the plant's contaminated wastewater and distiller's grain at up to 554,000 parts per billion. Since you last considered this bill, neonics have also been found up to 4 miles away from the Nebraska plant at toxic levels in waterways, and the cleanup of the plant continues to pose a challenge to the community there. Because treated seed is exempted from federal pesticide regulation, a similar situation could actually arise in Minnesota if this activity is not expressly prohibited. House File 766 does just that. In the years since the situation in Nebraska came to light, the seed industry has still not been transparent about their plans for disposal of excess treated seed. So while we know it is no longer going to this facility in Mead, we don't know how it is being handled or how it is planned to be handled. There are no assurances that ethanol plants in Minnesota or in other states are not accepting or could not accept treated seed for processing. In fact, the industry guidance about disposal actually still include ethanol processing as a recommended means of disposal for treated seed, even a year later. House File 766 would help ensure that excess treated seed is handled appropriately without placing a burden on farmers to figure out what to do with their excess seed. Unfortunately, the impacts of neonic treated seed can extend far beyond its use in fields. House File 766 is a small but critical step forward to reduce the risk that treated seed can pose to pollinators and communities across Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hoyle. Next up, we have Patrick Murray. Please identify yourself for the record and offer your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Sundin and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Murray. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. MCPR is a nonprofit organization representing agricultural retailers and distributors, crop input suppliers, crop advisors, and restaurants who manufacture crop inputs for farmers throughout Minnesota. I thank you for the opportunity to provide comments in opposition to the Delete Everything 2 Amendment to House File 766. First, I would like to note that seed treatment products are highly regulated and undergo a thorough evaluation by the United States Environmental Protection Agency and applicable state agencies prior to commercialization. Application of seed treatment products to seed for commercial purposes is performed by certified applicators who must receive certification and update their licensure to be able to use seed treatment products to apply seed. According to MCPR's mission statement, we exist to promote the proper use, storage, and application of crop input in an environmentally safe and agronomically sound manner. This is something that our members take very seriously. In fact, many of our members and applicators who they employ receive their certification and updates to their licensure by obtaining educational credits at the Crop Pest Management Short Course and MCPR Trade Show that is held in December in downtown Minneapolis every year. In fact, this event is a partnership between the University of Minnesota Extension, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers to ensure that these applicators receive the most up-to-date information as it relates to many topics, including seed treatments. Minnesota's crop production retailers and their applicators stringently follow all laws, regulations, and guidelines for the safe use and disposal of treated seed. Seed companies also work closely with the industry and grower partners to communicate the importance of following proper guidelines at every step of the process, including the proper disposal of unused or damaged seeds. Information can also be found on these practices at www.seedtreatment.org www.seed-treatment-guide.com. In addition, the provisions contained within the DE2 could restrict farmers' access to existing products that have gone through a science-based registration process implemented by the US EPA and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture under the provisions of FIPRA, the Food Quality Protection Act, and the Minnesota State Seed Law. I would also like to note that an opposition letter was included in the members' packets and posted online. It was signed by a host of Minnesota agriculture organizations, including the Minnesota AgriGrowth Council, Minnesota Corn Growers Association, Minnesota Farm Bureau, Minnesota Grain and Feed Association, Minnesota Soybean Growers Association, Biotechnology Innovation Organization, Cooperative Network, Midwest Food Products Association, and MCPR. In closing, MCPR once again respectfully opposes the Delete Everything 2 amended as well as House File 766. Based on what I've shared and submitted, this legislation would be duplicative and ultimately impact Minnesota's farmers by restricting their control options. Thank you, Chair Sundin and committee members for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Next up, we have Margaret Monson. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, committee members and Chair Sundin. My name is Margaret Munson. I'm an entomologist and a beekeeper, and I live in St. Paul. And I am testifying for the Land Stewardship Project and Pollinator Friendly Alliance, asking for your support for House File 766, requiring additional seed labeling, prohibiting certain seed uses, and for ethical and responsible stewardship for corn and soybean seeds, coated or treated with any of the neonicotinoid pesticides. For over a decade, research worldwide has documented that the use of systemic insecticides, including the neonicotinoids, negatively affect native bees and honeybees, and also that aquatic invertebrates have been impacted from chemical runoff from ag fields and into aquatic habitats. In October of 21, 37 local and national environmental organizations, including Land Stewardship Project and Pollinate Minnesota, signed onto a letter to President Biden asking for major reform needed in the EPA Office of Pesticide Programs, which I'll abbreviate OPP, because of the failure of the EPA to protect humans and the environment from increasing dangers of pesticides. The U.S. has over 18,000 separate pesticide products, more than any other country, used on over 250 million acres of farmland, not including the millions of acres of urban and suburban land. It is believed that the OPP's crucial regulatory mistakes have led to human health problems, impacted beekeepers' livelihoods, led to monarch population decreases, sometimes over 90%, massive national bird population declines, farmland birds taking the biggest hit, and noticeable loss of invertebrate populations upon which the birds depend. Sampling studies have found neonics common in almost every rural water body, and there is experimental evidence revealing neonic-driven decline in aquatic emerging insects, both in terms of species richness and biomass. The EPA sets benchmarks values to represent levels below which pesticides are not expected to harm wildlife, but 81% of water samples containing neonics were above the benchmark, indicating significant risk to aquatic insects and ecosystems. Insects and other invertebrates are what literally sustain our waterways and our wetlands, so they're critical to ecological integrity. When we lose the insects that are nature's most important part of the food web, we're basically affecting the welfare of the entire country. So in spite of the OPP's systematic refusal to comply with interagency consultation requirements, Section A-2 of the Endangered Species Act, the OPP continues to register thousands of pesticides. In fact, their approval of the neonicotinoids directly correlates with the beginning of the serious losses and decimation of honeybee hives nationally. Currently, there's still between 30 and as much as 50% of hives being lost. This is unsustainable. The evidence of the dangers of systemic pesticides in the environment and the implications from poor handling of treated seeds reach far beyond what happened in Mead, Nebraska. Minnesota needs regulations that restrict the use of treated and coated seeds so they cannot be sold as food, fuel, oil, feed, or ethanol, and that any excess seed must be properly disposed of so no contamination occurs to soil, adjacent waterways, and human and wildlife communities. It's the least we can do to take these steps to offer a measure of protection for the health of Minnesotans who are exposed to chemically treated seeds and to protect the soil and water on land in ag production, and to protect all of the terrestrial and aquatic forms from insects to the birds that depend on them. So please support House File 766, and thank you for allowing me time today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. To the committee, we do have department specialists on tap here and others. There's some written testimony, both sides of the issue, so please pay attention to that. Questions from the committee? I see Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, unless I'm looking at a different bill, the testimony we just heard was a pretty much up and down the line against the use of neonicotinoids. And Mr. Chair, respectfully, that's not what this bill is about. This is about the disposal of unused seed that contains neonics. It's not about whether or not we use neonicotinoids in our cropping practices. And I find it a little bit ironic that at a time when we are, there's a war going on in another part of the world, and there are actually discussions and talks about food shortages in the Middle East and in the Far East with exports coming to a very slow process for both Ukraine and for Russia. Again, they're talking about food shortages. And here we are in the Minnesota legislature talking about more ways to curtail production of food in our country and in our state. You know, the European Union recently took away basically what's called their CRP. It's about 6% of their tillable land in Europe. They're going to use that this year to grow more crops, to get more food to feed people. There's also talk in this country of opening up our CRP program to grow more crops and food to feed people around the world. So I find it very ironic that we are talking about taking away practices in Minnesota that would help farmers produce bigger crops, better crops, and more food for people around the world. Just one quick question, Mr. Chair, for Representative Hansen. He makes it very clear in Section 5 of the bill that the Pollution Control Agency would have rulemaking in terms of the lawful disposal of unwanted and unused seed treated with neonicotinoids. My question is, when I finish planting my corn and I have 5 bags of seed left, that's unused seed. Does that then become the jurisdiction of the Pollution Control Agency? Representative Hansen.
Representative Hansen, please. Chair Hansen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. That is precisely why we need to clarify that. You would be able to use that seed as long as it's viable, but what happens, let's say you use 3 bags, but you've got 2 left over that you can't dispose of. You can't use because they're no longer viable after 2 or 3 years. So how do you properly dispose of it? That's what the rulemaking is to clarify that through an open public process on how do you properly dispose of the seed. Mr. Murray talked about the application of a pesticide. That is not what this bill is about.
I agree.
It's not about the application of a pesticide. It is how do you dispose of a seed that has been treated with a pesticide once it's no longer viable to be used. And that can be a choice by the person who uses it or that it no longer is viable in terms of its life. So that is what happened. The seed that was unused was shipped. And we had testimony last year, shipped from Minnesota to Nebraska, along with all the other states around there. And it was used for the production of ethanol. So what this bill simply does, as amended, is it says you can't use it to make ethanol. And as long as you can't use it to make ethanol, you can use it to make ethanol. That, until we pass a law to say you can't use it for ethanol, you could, because there's not a law there. What the bill says on Section 4, a person, and I want to really state this clearly, because this is what every one of those ag groups just signed on to, opposing, a person must not dispose of seed treated with a neonicotinoid pesticide by burial near a drinking water source or any creek, stream, river, lake, or other surface water, composting, or incinerating within a home or another dwelling. So burning it in your house is okay, apparently, for those ag groups. We're not talking about the application of a pesticide. We're trying to find out through a normal rulemaking process of where things start and stop. Disposal and solid waste are with the Pollution Control Agency. I've talked with Commissioner Peterson repeatedly about this. The seed law takes it until it's used or can no longer be used. When is it solid waste? And the guidance to help you, Representative Anderson, we're putting money in to help provide that answer for people so they know what to do. That's what the bill does.
Okay. Representative Anderson, something further?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to answer, I guess, my own question about what I would do with those five unused bags of seed, I would take those back to my co-op, my seed dealer. They would return those to the company. They would be retested for germination, and they'd be used again in the following year. So again, that process to me seems like it works very well. And to Representative Hansen's comments about Section 4, do we need a law to tell people not to burn treated seed in their corn burning stove? I would hope not. And I don't think anybody with common sense would bury treated seed near a creek, stream, river, lake either. So, is the law necessary? I guess that's up to the eye of the beholder. But I think farmers have a whole lot more common sense than that, and we don't need this piece of legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lippert, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment here. I wanted to thank Representative Hansen for his work on this. I mean, I think the absence of law led to a really tragic situation in Nebraska. And I'm really concerned about the health and safety of people in rural communities, no matter where that community might be, how many people are there. Everyone deserves clean air and clean and safe water to drink. In the situation we had in Mead, Nebraska, people got really sick. Reports of lungs burning, eyes burning, just extremely dangerous situations. And it's just a sign to us that we don't know where this seed is going. And when it's returned to the co-op, to the seed dealer, we don't know for sure where it goes from there. So we need this effort to make sure that treated seed is properly disposed of to protect the health and safety of people in our communities across the state. So I appreciate the effort. I appreciate the bill, the revisions, and we need this in place for the safety of people in our communities.
Well, thank you, Representative Lippert. Last call for comments or questions to the author. Okay, seeing none, there's some written testimony again, a reminder of that. No further questions. Representative Chair Hansen, you get the last word.
I'd ask for your support.
Okay, thank you. House File 766, as amended, is before us. Mr. Smith, please call the vote.
Chair Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin votes aye. Vice Chair Vang.
Aye.
Votes aye. Representative Anderson.
Anderson, nay.
Anderson, no. Representative Burkle.
Burkle, no.
Burkle, no. Representative Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen R.
Hansen R, aye.
Hansen R, aye. Representative Hansen J.
Hansen J, aye.
Hansen J, aye. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, aye.
Cleavorn, aye. Representative Lippert.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Representative Lewick.
Lewick, no.
Lewick, no. Representative Miller.
Miller, no.
Miller, no. Representative Nelson.
Nelson, no.
Nelson, no. Representative Thompson. Representative Thompson. We have 7 ayes and 5 nays, Mr. Chair.
Okay, there being 7 ayes and 5 nays, that motion prevails. House File 766, as amended, is on to the Environment Committee. That's it for the agenda today, but I'm glad we have adequate time to talk about the avian influenza. We have Commissioner Peterson and hopefully company on tap to share some information. Commissioner Peterson, please.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Peterson is not available, but it looks like Dr. Thompson was able to join in and Deputy Commissioner Vaubel are available.
That's terrific. Dr. Thompson, please. identify yourself and please offer us some information.
Mr. Chair, Beth Thompson, State Veterinarian and Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. Can you hear me okay?
Perfectly, thank you.
Thank you, and thank you all to this, Mr. Chair and members, for this opportunity to present an update on the highly pathogenic avian influenza situation here in the state of Minnesota as of today. You all may have been following the news this weekend. We currently have three sites within the state of Minnesota that have been diagnosed with highly pathogenic avian influenza, or I'll just say AI. Those sites include a commercial turkey flock in Meeker County, a backyard mixed flock in Maurer County, and then another commercial turkey flock located in Stearns County. We have been watching this virus, and my testimony in previous hearings has been about how this virus has traveled. It's been circulating in Europe for a few years, traveled over into Canada with the first detection at the end of 2021, and then made its way across part of the United States, the migratory waterfowl flyways into Minnesota now. The first detection of this virus in the United States in 2022 was in Indiana in commercial turkey flocks. As of today, looking at the USDA website, we have detections in both backyard and commercial poultry flocks in 18 states on approximately 80 farms. So this is a very serious outbreak. We know, and especially too, looking to our west, South Dakota has experienced, I think they're getting close to 20 farms or sites with highly pathogenic avian influenza. The Board of Animal Health is a smaller agency. We have a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Agriculture. We have stood up the Agriculture Incident Management Team. And also this weekend, we reached out to our federal partners who will be sending in also an emergency management team to the state of Minnesota. They're due to be here mid to late week this week. We are imploring both. We know that this virus, Mr. Chair and members, is affecting all species. We've had outbreaks in turkeys, laying chickens, broiler chickens, and then mixed flocks across the United States. So practicing good biosecurity is very important. Also keeping in contact with your veterinarian, or if anything's going on within a flock, to contact the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. And with that, I don't know if the Assistant Commissioner Vavo may have additional details that she might want to add, but I stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Thompson. Commissioner Vavo.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Andrew Vavel. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Ag. Can you hear me okay?
Great. Thank you.
I think Dr. Thompson covered a lot of it. We are ready to help, already stood up our incident management team, and already doing all we need to do to be ready and respond. I will also say we are doing weekly calls with legislators and stakeholders. So if you have interest in learning more about that or being on those calls, please do let me know. But we are grateful to have the leadership of Dr. Thompson and the Board of Animal Health, and we're feeling good about the response.
Okay, thank you. Representative Anderson, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Question for Dr. Thompson. Doctor, correct me if I'm wrong, but Indiana was one of the first states to have an outbreak in a commercial flock. I think they had five. And since they have had those first five, I don't believe they've had any other outbreaks. And it's been about 3 weeks or so, and they've taken down their quarantine zone areas in that state of Indiana. Do you look at that as a good sign in this overall very serious, very dangerous situation, that if the flocks are taken down quickly and soon, but in Indiana's case, they haven't had any cases now for close to a month. Do you see that as a good sign of how we can somewhat control this and keep the spread to a minimum?
Dr. Thompson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, members of the committee, yes, I believe that is a very important factor. As I try to explain to people, depopulation is not an easy task for anyone. It's certainly not easy for the person that owns the birds or takes care of that backyard flock, but depopulation is vitally important to stopping the virus in its tracks. So I agree, it is that is an important factor, Representative Anderson, along with others.
Anything further, Representative Anderson?
No.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we'll be looking forward to updates, but if this is going to be anything like 2015, we're in for a rough ride here. And Representative Burkle, can you tell us, give us a little history lesson on 2015, how it affected you?
I can't. I'd rather not, but I can't. I do think, you know, what we learned in 15 is going to be really relevant now. And I believe, you know, especially the investment made in Wilmer and in the testing procedure, testing protocols we've got there in the lab is going to help us out. We're going to have a good chance to, you know, get ahead of this. And of course, depopping as soon as possible is the most important thing. But I do have, can I just ask one quick question to Dr. Thompson? Maybe she can answer this. As far as testing any wild birds, and of course, given the fact that no matter what, a good biosecurity program is assuming that everything outside the barn is dirty, but I'm just curious about the protocol of any wild birds found. Let's say I was to find a wild, a dead goose outside a barn. What would be the protocol if I called that in to you or to the DNR? How would that bird become, who would have the protocol to test that bird?
Dr. Thompson, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Burkle, for that question. You point to a key component of the response. It's not just the Board of Animal Health. We would immediately contact the Department of Natural Resources. And just so everybody is aware, I was in a text conversation with Dr. Carstensen from DNR just today. Just so everybody is aware, too, now that we're talking about wild waterfowl, wild birds, it's come to my attention that the rehab center here in Minnesota has stopped taking birds, sick birds, because of what's going on with avian influenza. So it's important to be in contact with our partners on the wildlife side and keeping in contact with all that are involved with rehab too.
Thank you. I'm just wondering about the economic impact. Just to press upon the committee, the gravity of this situation in 2015. Can someone comment on how the farmers are actually impacted? How much? How many losses? How much loss was realized in 2015? Commissioner Bobble.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I think I'll let Dr. Thompson answer that. I think she'll have a better insight into that.
Okay, Dr. Thompson, please.
Yes, thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. The 2015 event here in Minnesota involved 23 counties. There were over 100 farms. There were 9 million birds affected, and according to the University of Minnesota economic analysis, I believe it was $650 million of economic impact.
Okay, thank you. Representative Miller, did you have a question? Representative Miller, please.
I did that old thing. Just to be anecdotal about it, the numbers that you heard, the local impact, understand that like we had layer burns just south of us that totaled, I think it was in between 3 and 4 million birds just at the one site that all had to be euthanized. A typical turkey barn is, I'm gonna let Representative Burkle tell the exact number because with him on here, I'll be wrong, but just to understand it's like 25,000 or so.
Yeah, that's pretty close.
Yeah, it's pretty close. So understand in just the local impact, we talked about numbers and raw data, but the impact was imagine going into your barn and the way they euthanized the turkeys was they would foam the building, basically suffocate them. And just to you can imagine how that affects the people at the farm just as much. These animals are in the care of us as human beings. And I think sometimes people make it come across as farmers are just there for the profit, but they know those animals and they care for them and they have to do difficult things like that. I think saying that it was traumatic is an understatement. It was just very, very difficult. So we're hoping the Board of Animal Health and the Department of Agriculture and all this, we can make this, minimize this as much as possible.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. It's a good discussion. Any further input on the avian influenza? Thank you. I guess we're adjourned. See no further questions. We are adjourned. Thank you.